Hello again, and welcome to The Quantum Leap. Coming up, new books on Ireland's industrial and engineering heritage, an electronic arts festival. And in our regular look at the natural world, we'll be asking what's on the wing this autumn. But as we head into the first bank holiday weekend of the winter, and following from the awful tragedies on the road last weekend, we look at road safety and how drivers behave on the road. Now, Professor Ray Fuller is based at the School of Psychology in Trinity College in Dublin, where he studies driver behaviour. And earlier, I caught up with him to watch some busy Dublin commuter traffic. And I began by asking him, does our behaviour change when we get behind the wheel of a car?
Well, there is some evidence that behaviour can change, because the thing about being in a car is that you're completely anonymous. So rather than being Pat Murphy from Mullingar, you're just the guy in the whatever car you happen to be driving. And so the kind of social pressures on your behaviour are essentially disappear. You're cocooned from them. And so behaviour can be perhaps a bit more regressive under those conditions.
And is it also that we kind of tend to think of our cars as our own sitting rooms? We've got music, a three-piece suite and a telephone and air conditioning.
Well, I think the thing about that is that in the old days, cars gave you a lot of feedback about speed, about risk and so on. Now they're so comfortable that you are essentially in a very, very safe environment, and you're simply not getting this feedback about the dangerous speed, perhaps, that you have adopted.
Now, there goes not the first, but one of the umpteenth people that we've seen this morning holding a phone to their ear while they're driving. Why is it that having a phone conversation while you're driving is considered different to tuning the radio, lighting a cigarette?
Well, I think the important thing is that when you're engaged in a conversation, you're using part of your attentional capacity to deal with that conversation. And the demands of the road also make demands on that attentional capacity. You can use it all up, essentially, or a large part of it, in the conversation. If something suddenly happens out there on the road, you may very well miss it altogether.
And is a handheld phone significantly different from hands-free?
Well, originally it was thought that that was the key problem, that people have one hand on the wheel and are distracted looking at the keys on the phone itself. But more recent research shows that it's actually engaging in a conversation that is the fundamental problem. You have to use your working memory to answer questions, for example, and that is using up this attentional capacity. And some people say, well, what about when you're talking to somebody in a car? But the point is, when there's somebody with you in a car, they can see the road situation, they can allow you to pause when it's appropriate, and so it's a rather different situation.
Speeding has been very much in the news this week, and one of the things that I've come to realise in recent years, particularly now with so many motorways, you get used to doing 120 kilometres an hour, and then you come off the motorway onto, say, a ramp or something like that, and you slow down, and it's very difficult, I've found, to judge speed by eye. I've come to think that speed is an optical illusion, and I thought that maybe with experience that one would learn to judge speed by eye, but that doesn't seem to be. So is there something psychological happening there?
Absolutely. There's a well-known problem called the speed adaptation effect, and if you drive at a high speed for a prolonged period, you get so used to that that when you come down to a slower speed, it seems much slower than in fact it really is. And so you can be going maybe 10 in research, you can be going up to 15 miles an hour, what's that now, 20 kilometres an hour faster than you think you are. And therefore, you come to a traffic island or something like that, too high a speed, and you perhaps end up with shunting somebody. I mean, there is a higher distribution of crashes off motorways, on the ramps coming off motorways, where people are going at too high a speed.
It's nothing to do with experience or inexperience. This is the psychology of speed.
It's the brain. It's the psychology of speed. One way of trying to control for that is to use pain lateral lines across the road, where the separation between them actually gets less and less. If you go across those at a steady speed, you get the impression that you're actually going faster. And this is one device. It's used on the Swords Road, for example, approaching the airport.
Different types of drivers. The old joke that there are two types of drivers. There's idiots and maniacs. The idiots are all the drivers who go slower than me. The maniacs are all the drivers who go faster than me. And obviously, I'm a great driver. Are there different types of drivers psychologically?
Emerging evidence, very interesting, because it's indicating that there are essentially four different kinds of driver. There's a high risk threshold driver. They're about 15% of drivers. These are people who drive with a very narrow safety margin. They think that going 100 miles, nothing to going 100 miles an hour. They're not concerned about breaching regulations. They typically will drive above the speed limit. if something untoward happens, they are in real trouble. They tend to be young and male. And then there's a group of low-risk drivers, about 40% of drivers. They drive with a large safety margin. They comply with speed limits. They're what we'd normally think of as a safe, responsible driver. And then there are two other smaller groups, each about 23% of drivers. One group are called opportunistic. They will break a speed limit if they think it is safe to do so. And they will use another lane to get past traffic approaching, for example, a roundabout. They're mainly male, incidentally, about 60% of those. And then there's a group, the fourth group, are what are called reactive drivers. These are mainly female drivers. And they tend to break the speed limit when they are angry or annoyed or irritated by something. Nevertheless, by and large, they are safe. But they do have this tendency to respond emotionally to what's going on the roadway.
There's been a lot of talk, in the last few days, arising out of the accidents last weekend, about putting restrictions on new drivers and having kind of different levels of licence, in a sense. Is there any merit from your research in that kind of approach?
I would think there's huge merit in that for a number of reasons. One is, what the evidence is showing is that a lot of these young drivers are simply not mature in terms of their general behaviour. That is, they are impulsive in their driving. They don't think of the consequences of their behaviour. They haven't essentially internalised our normal ethical code of being careful and courteous and considerate of other drivers and driving responsibly. I mean, we often use the phrase boy racers. Racing they may be, but the important word there is boy. They are not men behind the wheel. And anything that actually can enable the driver to be more mature when she or he is behind the wheel, then that is to be welcomed. And to extend driving training and require, for instance, a certain number of hours of experience on different kinds of roadway would seem to me to be a really good improvement in what we normally think of as driver training.
So the kind of thing that you do with pilots, you have to clock up air miles here, you'd have to clock up road miles before you're allowed on a motorway or vice versa.
That provides an ideal model, I would have thought.
Psychologist Ray Fuller from Trinity College in Dublin. You're listening to The Quantum Leap with me, Mary Mulvihill. And still to come, our industrial heritage and what engineers have done for Ireland, and also some electronic arts. Now, the National Institute for Cellular Biotechnology at Dublin City University has just moved into a fine new building. Peter Mooney went along to find out what they do there and what's involved in running a state-of-the-art biotechnology research centre.
Professor Martin Clines, you're the director of the National Institute for Cellular Biotechnology. Tell me a little bit about the work that goes on here.
It's centred around the technology of growing individual human and animal cells in isolation from the body and applying that technology in a number of areas, in particular trying to find better ways to treat cancer and trying to find tissue engineering or stem cell, adult stem cell type therapies for eye disease and diabetes. Also working closely with the biopharmaceutical industry in using cells to produce medical proteins.
In practical terms, what's the output of that kind of work?
Better drugs and better combinations of drugs for treating cancer, the ability to cure certain eye diseases, developing a program for islet transplant to help people with uncontrolled diabetes.
What kind of partners are you working with?
The partners we'd have in the hospitals, for example, would be people like John Crown in St Vincent's Hospital, Michael Moriarty in St Luke's, Andrew Bobart and William Power in the Eye and Ear Hospital, Dermot Smith and David Hickey in Beaumont Hospital, all who are directly involved with patients and who are very interested in working with us in applying the latest developments in biotechnology to better the treatment of patients. We are also working closely with Wyeth Biopharma in Grange Castle with a broad aim of trying to improve processes so that the cost of biopharmaceuticals, which is quite high, can come down. This is very important as more and more of these products like Herceptin come on the market, costing maybe 30,000 to 60,000 a year per patient treatment. And ultimately, if these are to be available to the wider patient population around the world, the costs have to come down.
How many researchers are working here in the Institute?
In total, in the Institute, including our partners in Maynooth and Tala, we have about 100 researchers.
That sounds like a lot of people working. Biotechnology is at the forefront of the government's policy for science, but there's also a difficulty in attracting people. Do you find it difficult to attract first-class researchers here?
I think we've been very lucky in the calibre of people that we've attracted, both Irish people and people of other nationalities indeed. However, I think for the long-term health of the research sector in Ireland, we have to address the issue of career structure and stability for researchers. At the moment, people work on grants. There are often gaps between funding schemes. People don't have the sort of stability they need to develop a career in research. So therefore, I fear we will lose good researchers when we should be retaining them in Ireland. I think the universities and the funding agencies and the government have to work together to find a solution to this. I don't think anybody is looking for the old permanent pensionable civil service type model, but I think what people would expect would be some sort of security with performance-based evaluation at periods, but some sort of security, some sort of continuity, and the normal benefits like pensions that most careers would expect. These generally are not available to researchers in Ireland, so I think radical change is needed and is needed soon if it's to complement the very welcome funding initiatives from the government over the past few years.
Okay, then, let me turn to Dunica O'Driscoll. Dunica, you're the general manager of this National Institute for Cellular Biotechnology. How do you go about creating a climate whereby researchers want to come and work in an institute like this?
Well, I suppose there's a number of things, like in any other job, that motivates people to come and work. First of all, it's the attractiveness of the type of work that's going on. And as Martin mentioned earlier, we have a lot of very good and engaging projects which involve us in working very closely with clinicians and with industry and in the areas of diabetes and cancer. So there's obviously the initial motivation of doing very good and practical type of research work. But also because of the huge investment made by the government and the various funding agencies, we now also have like a world-leading state-of-the-art facility. They not only can carry out their work in an interested sector, but can do it at a level using equipment which maybe 10 years ago or even 6 or 7 years ago one would only read about maybe in the larger research institutes in Europe or in the States, where it's now they know that when they come here, they can actually carry out their work really at the highest level and with the best of funding. Attracting in, of course, is only half the issue. The other one is trying to retain people. Obviously, retention is still a challenge for us.
So is finding money to enable the research to continue a big difficulty?
Well, it is a difficulty. It's always a difficulty. I should say at the outset that before we start complaining about not being able to get enough money, in fairness, the government since the late 90s have invested huge amounts of monies into third level research, especially in the biotechnology area. And indeed, if it wasn't for that investment, we wouldn't be facing the financial problems that we do have now, because we have been given very good infrastructure, we've been given very good equipment and people, but what that has done is raise the bar in continuity. It now is much more expensive and much more difficult in order to continue what is very good work that has started. So yes, it does become difficult. Unfortunately, one of the sole outlets for supply of funds at the moment is for specific projects. So you might get funding for 2 or 3 years on a specific project. However, in order to run a centre like this, there's a lot of administration, there's a lot of maintenance, there's a lot of, I suppose, some of the more unattractive sounding aspects of research that has to go on, and trying to fund the overheads and that in the background is becoming increasingly difficult.
So are you in competition with other institutes for funding, or is it a friendly rivalry?
It is fair to say that there is competition between research centres, and such competition in one sense helps maintain a good level of quality of work. All grants are won on a competitive basis. Now, obviously, in our day-to-day running, we seek to collaborate and work with other institutes. There's not ivory towers. However, obviously, there is greater desire to do research than there is funds to meet that desire. And there's a lot of good work being proposed continuously, and as time goes on, we seek to expand it. But there is a limited amount of funding, so everyone must present their argument. So in that respect, yes, we are competing, but also not just within the research centre, but research in itself is competing with every other sector as well. So there is also an aspect of camaraderie between all the groups within research to ensure that the overall research message is brought across to the government as well. But having said all that, it's still a very exciting time to be working in biotechnology, and at times the challenges make the work very interesting. And despite any problems that one comes across in the work, it's still a great place to come and to work, and it should excite students in school as well to one day hope to come into this sector.
Peter Mooney reporting there from the National Institute for Cellular Biotechnology in Dublin City University. Now, two big new books about Ireland's industrial and engineering heritage. They're both published by the Collins Press in Cork. They even have similar titles and some overlap in content. The first is Industrial Ireland, 1750 to 1930. It's by archaeologist Colin Rinn. And Engineering Ireland is edited by Ron Cox. Now, I should say at the start that I actually know both of these people. But then anyone interested in Irish industrial heritage is going to know them because they're big experts in the field. And with me to review the two books is architect Joan O'Connor. She's a former president of the Royal Institute of Architects in Ireland, and she also chaired the committee that chose the spire as the Millennium Monument for Dublin's O'Connell Street. So, Joan, you obviously have an eye for the future, but are you interested in the past, or architects generally interested in the past?
Well, most architects would say that the future is founded in the past. That's where every good idea comes from.
So the foundation, so to speak.
Foundation is in the past. And you're right to say they're two big books because they weigh a total of 4 kilos, so you won't be toting them around on an airplane. Industrial Ireland, Colin Rinn's book, is absolutely fascinating. 19 chapters about anything and everything to do with our industrial archaeology. That's both buildings, machinery, settlements, processes, etc.
And he takes them thematically. He does power, he does steam engines, fossil fuels, it goes through tanning, paper making, navigation.
It starts with the very basics of animal, wind and water power, which now in this era of sustainability is becoming of much more relevance to us. I can't see us bringing back the tread wheels or treadmills or the dog-powered roasting spits to which he refers.
I was intrigued, the treadmills, human treadmills were used in prisons.
Absolutely. It's a horrifying image. Now, yes. In fairness to Colin Rinn, he doesn't go into any gory details about the processes and that, but one's imagination tends to run away as you read about how leather was tanned years ago, and you can almost smell the revolting conditions in which it was done. I think this is a wonderful book. It has terrific illustrations, both in drawings and in photographs and in axonometrics and archaeological diagrams.
Axonometrics.
Oh, that's a three-dimensional view of something.
Okay. It actually is worth mentioning the illustrations because it really is richly illustrated. I think there's hardly a page.
And
he
took most of the photographs himself, which shows you that he has a very acute and keen eye for detail. So I enjoyed that.
Did you learn anything from the book yourself?
Oh, you could dive into this endlessly. I learned a huge amount, a whole lot of random things like that. We have the oldest copper mines in Europe, dating back to 2400 out on the Mizen Peninsula. I learned how linen was made, brewing and distilling and tanning and paper making. I learned about the atmospheric railway, which I had heard about in Dunleary, but never actually understood how it worked. And I didn't appreciate the fact that it had worked, in fact, for about 5 or 7 years before it was withdrawn.
This was the railway sucked up the hill.
Exactly, the vacuum principle.
Right, okay. I think I counted 19 pages of references. So it's very, very detailed. It's got an excellent index.
An excellent cross-referenced index. It's 450 pages. He must have had to just cut himself short at that because I'm sure he could have written endlessly about it. I hope he does another book going on from 1930 through to today.
Okay, who'd enjoy this book?
Everybody. I mean, engineers, obviously, and historians and archaeologists and architects and planners and county libraries and schools and anybody who's interested in the past.
Okay, well, let's take the second book. It's Engineering Ireland and it's edited by Ron Cox. Now, it's a publication or a project by the Irish Academy of Engineering. It weighs in slightly lighter. It's only 1.5 kilos, still heavy by most standards. And the chapters are written by some of the big names in Irish engineering. And like Colin Rinn's book, it also covers a range of topics from, I think, aviation and motoring to canals and computers. And it reflects in some ways how engineers have contributed to our economy and our quality of life. There's some overlap. I think two of the chapters are actually written by Colin Rinn, as it happens. What did you make of the second book, Joan?
It's a very worthy book, probably not as cohesive as the first book because it's a collection of essays on papers delivered on various occasions by very well-known engineers. The history of the profession is interesting and the history of the training of engineers was most interesting for anybody of an academic bent. James Doogue deals with engineering since 3000 BC when Newgrange was built. Some interesting illustrations. I found out where the word bohar comes from, a bohar. It's the width of a road required for a cow athwart the path and a cow passing by. And a ballach was the width of a pack horse. And that's kind of little nuggets of information that you find in it. There are some good illustrations. There's a lovely image of Kenmare Bridge, for instance. And talking about the bridge thing, they forecast, the author of that chapter forecast that between 2003 and 2010, there'd be 500 more bridges built in the Republic of Ireland.
Which is a stunning statistic.
Absolutely. I'm just hoping that the Sam Beckett Bridge, the Calatrava Bridge down in the docks, will be one of them at last.
Okay.
But, and that's putting in a little hint for the city manager. The other chapter that's interesting and topical is the one on rural electrification, because, as we know, it's the 60th anniversary of the project, and the first pole on the project was erected in North County Dublin on the 5th of November, 60 years ago. And it took until March 1980 to finish the project. And because we're celebrating the whole project at the moment, it's interesting to read that.
Who do you think would be most interested in this book?
Principally the profession, I would think, because it's quite a self-regarding book. Libraries, obviously. Maybe if an architectural office wanted to flatter the engineering profession, they might have it on their reception
desk. Okay, so that one for engineers. We've been discussing Industrial Ireland by Colin Rinn and Engineering Ireland, which is edited by Ron Cox. They're both large, heavy format, hardback books published by Collins Press, and you'll get a few pence change from €50. Joan O'Connor, thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
That's a piece of music composed by artist and musician Dennis McNulty. He's one of the performers in this year's Dublin Electronics Arts Festival, or the DEAF. It started yesterday and it goes until the bank holiday Monday the 31st. And Dennis joins me now to tell me about the festival and about his own work. Dennis, what is the festival?
Festival probably came out of club culture. About 5 years ago, a few people got together and decided that this kind of particular area was a little bit unrepresented in Dublin. So they decided to put together a festival that showcased the best in Irish electronic art. So I guess it began with music, but it has kind of moved into the areas of visual art and kind of theatre almost as well.
So what kind of things can people expect?
There are club events in various clubs around town, lots of DJs in bars all day, kind of DJing events all weekend. But there are also more art-related events. For example, the project I'm doing, there's also a film screening in the Sugar Club on Saturday night, I think. There's a showcase of experimental music on Sunday. There's the Dublin Guitar Quartet are playing a concert in the National Concert Hall on Friday afternoon.
And I gather also a play in Trinity that's running for a few nights, that's a collaboration with engineers. And we'll put a link to the festival website so that people can get the programme details. Your own work, do you describe yourself as an artist, a musician, a composer?
I kind of, not really a composer as such, but an artist-musician, kind of a hybrid, I suppose, you know.
Okay, and what are you going to be performing? And because it's quite unusual.
Yeah, I guess so. It comes from both sides, this project that I'm doing. It comes from my interest in music and my interest in art. It follows on from a project I did in Brazil earlier on this year. I call it an anti-tour, and the idea is to do a tour, like a musical tour, but to invert some of the ideas in it. So I actually send out a call for venues and ask people to let me play in their apartments.
And you're specifically interested in apartments built, I think, in the 1990s.
Yeah, that's true. I think for each anti-tour, there's some idea that it's almost like an experiment in a way, where I'm setting up a set of initial conditions to see what will happen. So it's a kind of an investigation in Dublin, you know, because I've grown up here and I've seen the radical changes that have happened in the last 10 years.
And you're not just looking for apartments built in the 1990s, but you'd also like to play in people's homes between the hours of 11:20 at night and midnight.
When I played in Brazil, I timed the concerts to happen at magic hour, which is the time when the light is changing, when the sun is going down. So it's kind of to create a perceptual space, you know, so your perception of sound changes very much as light changes. So it's about that. So in Dublin, I'm trying to create this kind of ritualistic aspect by having them all end at midnight. But I'm actually going to play a DVD in the apartment that fades from white to black. So as I'm playing, the light will actually change as well.
So. Okay, and have you enough offers of apartments?
Yeah, up until recently I only had two, but then there's been this kind of wave of interest, so I've had another couple of offers in the last day or so it's great.
Very good. Well, we put a link to the festival website, as I say, from our own programme website at rte.ie/radio1/quantum, and of course a link to Dennis's own website. And let's hear some more of Dennis's music. Right, now time for our weekly look at the natural world. And this week we're focusing on the arrivals and departures of the many birds who are seasonal visitors to our shore. The summer visitors have gone, winter visitors are arriving, but it's been a long and mild autumn. So did the summer visitors stay longer this year? Well, joining me on the line is Eric Dempsey. He's director of the Birds of Ireland News Service. Eric, who has been first and last to go this autumn?
Birds like swallows. Some of them have stayed and tried to raise maybe a third or fourth brood, which is a little bit unusual, but it has been happening in the last few years. Basically, if it's warm, there's enough insects to possibly try and rear a brood. For that reason, I've seen swallows in the last day or two still lingering in South Wexford, and these are possibly young birds that are fledged quite late. So they're really only beginning to go now, but by and large, most of our summer migrants are well and truly gone now at this stage, and some of them, like cuckoos, which have left very, very early, are already down in South Africa at this stage.
And those late swallows, are they going to get caught in bad winter weather because they've left it too late?
Well, now, this is a big question, Mary, because are these birds going to make it down to South Africa? Most likely not. An awful lot of swallows are now spending the winter in the likes of the south of Spain, in the Mediterranean basin. And again, that is possibly a sign of global warming, in that there's enough insects now to sustain a wintering population of swallows in the Mediterranean. So Irish birds, Irish swallows, for example, have two distinct wintering grounds. 99.9% of them will go to South Africa, but a small percentage of them are now just going as far as the likes of Spain, North Africa, and are not moving further south.
Okay, very quickly, what about anything arriving in?
We've had big numbers of geese arriving in the last few weeks. Once it gets cold in the northern hemisphere, all of the geese, all of the waders, the ducks are all in. Down in the Wexford North Slobs yesterday, there was big numbers of Greenland white-fronted geese arriving in, and quite excitingly, there's a snow goose with them, which is from North America. So that has come in with those birds at the moment.
Okay, lovely. That's Eric Dempsey. Thank you for that, Eric Dempsey of the Birds of Ireland News Service. And the Wexford Slobs, always a good place to see geese. We'll put a link to all the items in this week's programme on our website at rte.ie/radio1. And if you'd like to contact the programme, as always, our email is quantum@rte.ie. Next week, we take a special quantum leap into the Irish Sea when we spend a day on board the Marine Institute's research vessel. Until then, from me, Mary Mulvihill, Sláinte.